took this journey of this through this film. And what I learned was that all of these people had a different kind of courage, and they had the courage to be vulnerable. They had the courage to share their experience. And that was something that each person's experience was unique. Each person's way of sharing their vulnerability was completely different. But I really rewired my sense of courage. And they are all badasses, but they're not just military badasses, they're emotional badasses. And that was something that I didn't expect and inspires me every day now.
Thank you for joining us for the Woodstock Film Festival Let's Talk Film podcast. I'm your host, Katie Mejia. Established in 2000, the Woodstock Film Festival is a not-for-profit 501c3 organization that nurtures and supports emerging and established filmmakers, sharing their creative voices through an annual festival and year-round programming to promote culture, diversity, community, educational opportunities, and economic growth. The film festival takes place usually at the end of September, and so this year, 2023, it's September 27th to October 1st. Today, I am joined by two very special guests, Jack Youngleson and Sean Edwards Beal, the filmmakers behind the award-winning documentary film, Here Is Better. The film interweaves the inspiring stories of men and women, veterans overcoming the debilitating effects of PTSD with treatments that can work, bringing hope to millions. You can see the film in select theaters on June 23rd and on digital June 27th. Thanks for joining me for the podcast.
Thank you so much for having us.
So just to kick it off, we usually start the festival, the podcast by talking about the festival. And so you had your world premiere of this film, of Here Is Better, at the Woodstock Film Festival to a sold out audience in the Bearsville Theater last year. So can you tell us what that experience was like? And we can start with Jack.
Sure. It was incredibly special to be able to show it at Woodstock, especially being so close to New York City, where we, where we cut the film and where all the editing happened. And we were able to bring participants who were in the film to the festival as well, to be there, including Jason Kander and Kate Chard and Jackie and Carolyn and also other people who were involved in the making of it. But beyond that, it's such an amazing film-centric audience. And for us, it really kicked off this sense that whatever or wherever we showed the film, it sparked really unique, beautiful conversations. And we really felt that impact. And especially also coming out of COVID, one of the first film festivals that was in person, it was really a special time to be there.
Perfect timing. And Sean, what was your experience?
Just like Jack, I mean, it was so special to be at Woodstock, and to have the subjects from the film there with us, sharing in that experience. They had not been at a film festival before, and it was really moving. And then to be in a theater with them, the film is incredibly impactful in a theater. There's no question about that. It really plays quite differently than on a laptop. And so being in a theater with the people in the film and the audience was something that I don't think I'll ever forget. It was just one of the most moving experiences. And then the Q&A afterwards, people standing up and talking about their own experience, it was sort of this immediate response to the film and to the people who had given us the privilege of being able to tell their stories.
And Diana Kander as well. I wanted to recall that she was there, of course.
Yes.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, were the subjects able to make other screenings? Was this kind of like the main one? And if so, was that part of the experience where you did Q&As in other places and then had people give feedback from the audience? And either one of you guys can take the questions whenever I ask.
There were some other opportunities and also some radio and other opportunities for participants to share. So, but Woodstock was the big kickoff.
It was the big kickoff. Beautiful. So I wanted to get in a little bit. To our audience likes to know how films are made, and a film like this is, you know, it's hard not to want to know, you know, how it was put together. And so I just wanted to start off with the process of creating the film. How did it come to be? How was it birthed?
Well, our executive producer had seen the New York Times article that said more people, more veterans had taken their own life than are killed in battle. And he really wanted to do something to address that in some way. And once he'd shared that article with us, it really was an extraordinary journey. I mean, at that moment, I was so shocked to receive that information, as was Jack. And so we signed on because we really wanted to be able to do that. There are many films that talk about PTSD, but there hadn't been one that wanted to look that had addressed the issue of healing. And that was something that really appealed to us both.
The healing modalities, I think, are the part that, you know, most people don't know about some of the ones. Can you guys just, since, you know, that's connected to what you're talking about, could you just discuss a little bit more of the healing modalities that you covered, that your subjects went through in the film?
Jack?
Sure. CPT, which is cognitive processing therapy, and then PE, which is prolonged exposure therapy, and then EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And those were the three that we looked at in the film, and they're highly vetted, and they're the kind of first line trauma therapies that are available, but there are others too, and other supporting modalities that can be used. But those are the three that we focused on in the film.
So how did you decide on those three? And then how did you decide on the people who had gone through the trauma? How did they come to be in the film?
Well, the three therapies are the most widely used, vetted psychotherapies that are available. And so that was the reason why we focused on those three. But again, there are other modalities that are out there. And the idea was to kind of open the door to the sense that it's not a one size fits all when it comes to therapy. And we didn't want to kind of exclude the possibility that there are others out there. I want to be clear that the film is not meant to be prescriptive as much as to begin a conversation.
Yeah, I wanted to read your director's statement, and it mentions that. You say, through their personal stories, the film seeks to bring understanding to how we collectively respond to trauma, to what a PTSD diagnosis means, and how PTSD can impact daily life, far removed from a military setting. The film does not seek to be prescriptive, but instead highlights how the right fit of trauma therapies and other support systems can help transform the darkness into light. How did the team come together? How do you guys put a team together like this? You know, it starts with the general theme, and then how is it all put together from sort of, you know, just the beginning? I know you guys said that it's a subject that you're interested in, but then sort of what's the next step? What was the next step after that for this project?
Well, I already knew that Jack was awesome because we were together like 10 years prior. And it's weird. I mean, I think as a producer, you, you know, that's putting together the right team is sort of the alchemy and the thing that you hope for. And Jack was just my first thought. The minute that I met with Bill, I think I might have even texted you on the way back, Jack, from that first meeting. I was kind of like, you haven't heard from me for a while, Jack, but I just want to, you know, talk to you about something. Because I knew that Jack has this level of kind of, he's a great intellect, but he's also a super sensitive person in relation to kind of human interactions. And I knew that we were going to need somebody who could relate on multiple different levels to what we were about to, you know, embark upon. Our co-producer Chloe Hall was somebody that I had also worked with before, and I introduced her to Jack, and Jack immediately wanted to bring her onto the team. And she was specifically focused on finding the female vets in NAR. And found us our way to the Cincinnati VA trauma center, and then Jack, maybe you want to talk about camera and editing.
Sure. Well, yeah, we had an incredible cinematographer Daniel Carter, who did all the filming and used prime lenses as a not to get too technical about it, but
you can. I mean, we get technical on this podcast. Okay. I mean, it's beautifully shot. I mean, it's just incredible. Yeah. You're so immersed in it immediately with the lenses alone. I mean, wow, it's amazing. Yeah.
It's something that Sean had encouraged us to consider from the very beginning. And I know you're taking a gamble with it because you don't have as many cutting choices in the edit room as you would with zoom lenses. But I mean, Daniel loves shooting on prime lenses, loves that kind of cinematic look that you get with it and that intimacy, because we realized we'd be in therapy sessions and we'd be in these very personal environments. And we wanted to kind of make you feel like you were there. And I think he did a really outstanding, stunning job. And then we were so fortunate to work with Karen Sim, who's an amazing editor, who really found the weave between these stories and found the way that these journeys intersect. And we were editing in a COVID window where we were all separate and communicating on Zoom until the very end. And so that's not an easy process, but we were so lucky to have such a gifted editor working on the film too. And maybe Sean can speak to the music. It's the whole other part of it.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that was another piece. My husband and business partner, David Beale, is a musician, but he's also he's a man of many talents. But he has a lot of, his whole life has been around music. And so he brought David Barron to the table, and David Barron brought Jeremiah Frades from the Lumineers in to do the soundtrack. And they immediately responded to the material that they saw, which was terrific. And David also brought us Josen, who did that incredible song that is what we call the night montage sequence, which is when Tabitha can't sleep, and just created something so beautiful for that moment. And so, you know, it sort of speaks to the trouble, but I think draws you into Tabitha's and Michelle, who you see working at night, who can't sleep either. It really draws you into that sort of that experience. And then the amazing Wesley Schultz and David Kushner created this extraordinary credit song too, David Kushner is a global sensation, but his mission is to be positive and to create positive art for his audiences. So it was a wonderful fit, and Jack and Karen worked long hours on that soundtrack with David and Jeremiah, and Wesley came in with David Kushner. So it was, a film like this takes, thank you for asking, because it takes an extraordinary team. And I will say, as a producer, I've rarely worked with such a group of people who were so committed and so able to navigate this territory with sensitivity and creativity and bring their best game to the table. And that was a really special experience. And over this long time period, people put in a lot of time and a lot of hours. And that started with Jack and carried on throughout the entire film.
Yeah, I mean, spending that much time on the music does so much justice to it and just makes it so much more powerful. Usually an indie film or a documentary film, I mean, there isn't going to be that much time and energy put into the music because it's sort of the last, unfortunately, I'm a musician too, and it's always like the last thing. So I think that's so beautiful that you guys chose to do that, to just spend that much time. And, you know, I guess your husband is connected, so you were able to really, to really dive deep into that piece, because that part of the film just, it's such a serious topic. It's so deep that when you have gentle, beautiful, kind of lush music, you can kind of just, you know what I mean? And it's hopeful. And there's just things that sort of lift you, even though it's so heavy. And you don't know that it's also the lenses and the things like that that can kind of artistically lift you out of something that's so dark and hard to watch, you know? But it wasn't so much, because I think of those kinds of choices, but they're subtle and you don't necessarily know that. So thanks for speaking about that.
It was totally, yeah, it was very conscious, that desire to make something that was cinematically brought you in for all the reasons that you're saying, Katie, because we knew that once you were there, it was going to demand, it was going to be demanding.
after these particular individuals continue, is there a point when they sort of say, okay, I'm sort of done with service because of this, or do people just continue, would people continue to go and serve? Like, I mean, we're perpetually in a state of war, so there's just any point they could go and be in another war. Do you think that that's something they would do, or do they choose to sort of step back and not get involved again in something like that would trigger PTSD?
I could say that some of the individuals we spoke with and were featured in the film said, if I can go back, I would. If I could do another tour, I would. I mean, there's a great sense of honor and commitment. I'm not saying that's everyone for sure, but we did hear that. We did hear that.
Wow. How did you get access to the subjects? It's always a question that filmmakers are interested in.
We reached out to different veterans groups initially to find people and to start our own research. You know, we wanted to educate ourselves on the issues and on the space. So we sort of started this journey that was really about understanding what was going on with PTSD, and then also that sort of led us to different groups and different people, and then we found people at those groups. People recommended people and said so-and-so, you know, might be interested in sharing their particular story.
It's such a sensitive area, and we're filming in therapy, and we're filming in recovery. And, you know, we were very clear from the beginning about like what the subjects were comfortable with and what they weren't comfortable with. Some people didn't want to be filmed, and of course we respected that. Others were okay with us filming in group therapy, but not in one-on-one therapy. Others said you can film in the one-on-one therapy. And so decisions were made around that. And also in Cincinnati, we filmed over the course of 8 weeks, but we weren't there every single day. And we certainly weren't there for every single therapy session. And there were also moments where someone didn't feel comfortable with certain topics being filmed. And of course, we respected that. And so it was an ongoing dialogue and building and committing to a sense of trust and respect as we did the filming.
Right. So a lot of filmmakers themselves will take on a subject because they knew someone in their family who had PTSD, or somebody, you know, even maybe the filmmaker themselves. Is there anybody within your group? You know, it's so common. I mean, my grandfather had it and, you know, totally undiagnosed. You had a Vietnam veteran in the film, and, you know, there was no, there was really no diagnosis, and then there was no treatment prior to what year? I mean, it was very recent.
My father-in-law was a D-Day veteran. So my mother-in-law had said to me after he had passed away that she really wished he had gone and spoken to somebody, was how she described it. She said there was definitely stuff going on, but, you know, it didn't even occur to them to go and have a conversation with somebody to find a therapist. And that's, you know, the wonderful thing is how far we have come since then, but it still is a, you know, a stigmatized topic. And that's why, you know, making the film was very important to us.
And then the second question, you know, there's a lot of organizations will help out. Were these government organizations? I mean, because it's troubling in the sense, you know, one of the subjects, she says, you know, that basically she literally was told every day to like hold in her feelings, and, you know, and that she, cause someone could die. Like, you know, basically it was like, don't mess up, keep your feelings at bay because someone's going to get killed. And so she was told that on every mission. So it sort of was programmed in her mind. I mean, it's more or less like the problem was created by this war culture that we have. And then it was like, okay, now we're going to try to help you guys fix it. Are the services provided by the government sufficient? And are all these sort of outside organizations that will offer services?
It's a combination. I mean, the VA certainly provides services and features the three therapies that we're talking about, but also, you know, private therapists and other healthcare providers will also use these therapies. So it's not just a path through the VA to kind of access these treatments. I think there's also something that was important to us in the storytelling, which is, even though we focus on veterans, it's as much a focus on trauma more broadly. I mean, there's a line in the film which we hear, which is trauma is trauma is trauma. And so we want to make sure that other audiences, not just veterans and people in the service, go see this, because we feel that there are more universal themes to be mined here, especially when it comes to treatment and finding the right help.
Right. And so that's, I was curious, these were all the services provided by like the veterans through the government. These weren't outside organizations. They were just all the same type of organization that is funded by the government. That was my question.
Oh, no, there are some private therapists in there as well who are providing, like the EMDR might work in an ancillary way with the VA, but also providing services on a private basis. So,
right. Okay. So yeah, that was kind of my question, because it's so hard, you know, you guys didn't really bring up that so much. I realized your focus was just healing, you know, and that's really important, and you want to focus on that, you know. And I think it was like a recent Democracy Now! episode, they said that the U.S. has about 750 overseas military bases, 80 countries and colonies around the world, which is more bases than any nation, empire, or people in world history. And, you know, they're always pushing to build more, and the U.S. government is sort of perpetually in a state of war. And, you know, as filmmakers and activists, you're stepping in through this film to provide like that much needed medicine to millions of sufferers of PTSD, you know, and also outside of the military. What do you think their response to a film like this is? Is this something they would share, or do you have those kinds of connections to have it sort of shown more widely to the military itself?
We hope so. We hope it can be seen in all sorts of different environments. If that's VA centers or community centers or places of worship, or, you know, we really hope that it can be seen not exclusively, again, you know, through the VA or military channels, but can reach a much wider audience. We hope it touches a lot of people in that way.
And have they responded well to like being supportive and wanting to share it, or how has that been?
Yes, I mean, for sure. I mean, we're at the very beginning of a grassroots campaign where it will be seen widely. And so that placement will be seen on the website, and there'll be other news about that. But because the film, in large measure, focuses on paths toward healing, we never meant to kind of create a sugar-coated version of what PTSD looks like. I think it's a very intense experience watching the film and being along on the journey with the individuals featured in it. But at the same time, I think there is cause for hope, or a cause for realizing that treatment is out there if you know where to look. And for both of us, for the entire filming scene, that was really a critical part of the desire of what the film can do.
Great. I have a question for Sean. So what was your personal experience interacting with the individuals in your film? You know, as a producer, I know you're sort of running around, you know, doing so many different things. But how was it in it learning their story and gaining an intimate understanding of their trauma, since you had a family member also connected?
It was very different with each person. You know, every single person, I learned something extraordinary and new and different, both about their experience with trauma. And also I really learned something about courage. You know, what I realized during the course of the film is, you know, I went in to sort of meet these people, and I was like, oh, we're going to meet military people. They're going to be real badasses. They're really like, you know, this is what military people are. They are these extraordinarily courageous people. But when we think about courage, we think about people being stoic traditionally. We think about people not speaking about their feelings and not doing anything. And then we took this journey of this through this film. And what I learned was that all of these people had a different kind of courage, and they had the courage to be vulnerable. They had the courage to share their experience. And that was something that each person's experience was unique. Each person's way of sharing their vulnerability was completely different. But I really rewired my sense of courage. And they are all badasses, but they're not just military badasses, they're emotional badasses. And that was something that I didn't expect and inspires me every day now.
Yeah, it's truly incredible that they were allowing you to go along with their incredible challenges with their families. I mean, it was just so intimate, and you know, they were just so open, you know. And I there are certain types of personalities who are willing to do that because they just sensed in their heart that it was going to help others. And that was also, you could tell, it was like freeing for them to be able to, while they're going through what they're doing, help others, which shifts the energy a lot too, you know, for them. Because now, are you kidding? When they go, I mean, I can only imagine what the world premiere at the Woodstock Film Festival, them seeing that. And like you said, it's such an amazing experience on a large screen, not just on a laptop, sharing it with others. So, I mean, you've got multiple healing happening. You had sort of the actual process of it, you know, which goes on forever. I mean, it was like an 8-week program or 6-week. And, you know, of course it goes on for life, and you'll do multiple programs and different healing modalities. But part of their therapy and the healing too was, I'm sure, to be a part of these gatherings of people and to share it. And the Q&As, I can imagine the people also wanting to share that have the PTSD themselves, opening up that dialogue, you know? And so there's that ultimate sort of every time they see it healing, probably, when every time they experience it. So it's just so many layers of healing. And I also find it interesting that this is one of the first films that really just focuses on the healing part, which, because it's so important. And, you know, I've seen several and known many people who have had trauma, and they've used so many different healing modalities, multiple healing modalities. So they'll start with the sort of standard ones. And then there's, you know, they'll go to Peru with the shaman. Indigenous people, you know, have incredible healing techniques. They'll go and do ayahuasca or, you know, other ways of healing from our ancestors, that, you know, everyone had experienced some form of this in some way. But going back to the idea that these veterans, right, are willing to still hold on to that, even though they know the source of their trauma. Like, for instance, almost all of the veterans wore something in their civilian clothes that illustrated their service or their status as a veteran, even though they grapple with guilt and intense self-blame from their time of war. Why do you think they still are inclined to communicate their veteran status?
Jack, do you want to speak to that?
Sure. I mean, I think that we heard it from multiple people, that multiple veterans, that their time in the service created the most intense personal bonds with others. Like, that was their community. And those are the people they know and trusted, and there's a language, and there's a whole world that exists. And so when then you're cast into the civilian life, what's your identity and who do you connect with? And do you still have that bond? And for many, that's a struggle. And I think for Jason, for example, you know, he's working with an organization called Veterans Community Project now, building homes, tiny homes for homeless veterans. And he found his community once again in a world where he was among veterans. It was very important to him. And so I think it's a, you know, it's an ongoing seeking to find community, to find people who understand your experience. And I totally understand why they, you know, still honor and cherish that experience in that time, even though maybe the trauma developed while in the service itself.
It's very demanding. But again, I felt like my spirit felt lifted. You know, I didn't feel that heavy sense that you can feel when you watch, you know, some stuff on PBS and Frontline, and, you know, more just straight journalism, just putting that artistic craft into it is what really sets it apart. I mean, it's just a really beautiful film. And I want to thank you guys so much for being on the podcast. I also want to just plug again, you guys have it in theaters, select theaters, June 23rd. And then it's on just, you say, all digital platforms, June 27th. Is there any more information you can give our audience about where they can see the film?
Sure. If you go to hearsbetter.org, all the ticket information is there. And on June 23rd, it opens at the Quad in New York and the Lemley Monica in California. And on the 23rd in New York, we're having a Q&A that evening. And in California on the 24th, we'd love to pack those theaters. And it's so important that first week for an independent film like this to get people in the seats. So that day or any day, we would love for people to be there.
And it's an extraordinary experience in the cinema too. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I continue to share it as well. So, and you know, I'm sure others will too. The film, you know, and again, I hope you guys, if you're coming together again for a beautiful film like this, I hope that you make it to the Woodstock Film Festival, and would love to meet you guys in person and to see any more of your work, because this film is truly amazing. And I hope everyone that's watching watches it. So thanks again to Jack and Sean for joining us, the Woodstock Film Festival Let's Talk Film podcast. That's it for us. Please make sure you subscribe to our YouTube channel, hit the like button, and follow us on Instagram and Twitter. And we'll see you next time.